Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to the New Books Network, the Postscript podcast. This is Lily Gorin, and I'm joined today by my co-host in political science at the New Books Network, Susan LaBelle. And we are chatting today with Katie Dunn Tempest, who is a non-resident fellow at the Brookings Institution and has had deep and long experience studying, discussing, writing about, and analyzing the presidency, but particularly transitions. So thanks for joining us today, Katie. Sure. And I'm going to toss it over to Susan to throw out the first question.
Well, Katie, let's start with the unusual nature of this 2020 transition. First, you know, how do American transitions differ from other similar political systems in terms of the number and the type of new appointments that are made by the incoming president? And also, can you tell us a little bit about this particular transition? You know, unlike previous administrations, President-elect Biden will not have top national security cabinet officials confirmed as he takes office. How has this particular transition from President Trump to President-elect Biden been affected by the lack of a concession, the refusal of the head of the General Services Administration to certify, and how might it be affected by the pending article of impeachment?
Okay, great. Well, maybe what I'll do is start by giving you a little bit of a historical overview about presidential transitions, and then I'll move into what happened after Biden won the election. And then I can talk a little bit about presidential appointments that he's made and how they compare to his predecessors, as well as expectations for having your cabinet confirmed on Inauguration Day. So let me just start at the beginning and talk about this transition. In our country, after an election, there's a period of about 78 days before the president-elect becomes the president. What's unusual and really sets us apart is that in the United States, there are roughly 4,000 political appointments. And of those 4,000, roughly 1,300, 12 to 1,300 require Senate confirmation. So those represent the creme de la creme or the most senior, most influential positions. And what's unusual about this is that in similar sort of industrial democracies, they don't, if you can sort of use the pyramid as a figure of describing seniority in government positions, we basically lop off the top of the pyramid and start over every 4 or 8 years. And in other countries, they don't have nearly as many political appointees, which means you have institutional memory, you have experience, less likely to have a politicized bureaucracy. And also you take away a major portion of the transition is dedicated to its personnel for obvious reasons in the United States. I think that my colleague, Dave Lewis at Vanderbilt said that Denmark has 12 to 14 political appointees. Okay, that would be much more manageable to take care of that. And I understand that the countries are obviously different sizes. But nevertheless, there is an enormous burden on incoming presidents to staff a presidency. And the reason it's so important is because leadership matters and that it's very difficult. Our system is inclined towards status quo. And really what new presidents are trying to do is simply steer the ship of state in the direction that they want it to go. And in order to do that, you need leaders across the executive branch. And so if identifying individuals, making sure that they can be confirmed by vetting them, doing things of that nature will advance your cause once you're elected. So that's one of the most distinctive features, is just the sheer amount of political appointments that need to be made to run the government effectively. The other part is, you know, we do have 78 days. And in the case of President Biden, it was reduced by almost 3 weeks, or 25% of the 78 days, because Emily Murphy, the head of the GSA, was unwilling to ascertain that Biden was the president-elect. And I should point out that the transition process, just a quick historical overview on that. In the whole span of history, there have been presidential transitions, and it was until 1932-33, I believe, that presidents were elected in November, but not seated till March. And then the amendment changed it so that they would be seated in January, January 20th. And after that, after it passed under FDR, it wasn't until Dwight D. Eisenhower that it actually needed to be implemented. And Harry Truman, in some correspondence that I saw from the archives, invited Eisenhower to come to the White House to meet the cabinet and to talk to him and his vice president about governing and getting ready. And in this correspondence, he refused. He didn't think it would look good. So he didn't take him up on it. And this is the aftermath of, you know, World War II. I mean, you would think, and when Harry Truman wrote this letter, he couched it in the realm of foreign policy, that it's very important for you to understand where we're at and what you're going to be taking over. And he refused. And then going forward, the next sort of big moment in presidential transitions was JFK, who actually used some of his campaign funds to hire Clark Clifford and everybody's own favorite presidential scholar, Richard Neustadt, to sort of help him get ready for, he decided, I don't want to walk in there not knowing what I'm doing. I need some help. I actually need to spend money on this to really get a professional job and to get a professional briefing. So he spent his own money. You might not know that because shortly thereafter, the Bay of Pigs happened. But regardless, he at least was thinking ahead about the importance of taking over this vast government and the need to kind of understand what the pressing issues are. So anyway, as a result of his intention, though, finally, Congress sort of took part in this and said, OK, we need to do something more serious that formalizes this. And they passed the Presidential Transitions Act in 1963. And then going forward since then, there's been a number of amendments. And I would say, just to describe them broadly, they make it more organized, they provide more funding, and it's a longer period in which the transition funds are allowed and that candidates can use them. I would say the biggest change came after 9/11, because the 9/11 Commission recommended that not only do you give transitions more money for the process and the transfer of information related to national security, but you also allow the president-elect to have access to the president's daily brief. You sort of speed up the security clearance process for some of the president's aides so they can also be privy to this information. And at that point too, I believe it was the moment that they also allowed for what are called agency review teams. So after ascertainment, transitions have agency review teams that are dispersed throughout the government, and they basically go and interview people at all the different departments and agencies and basically ask them questions like, you know, what's boiling over? What do we need to worry about? What are the crises that you're dealing with at the moment? And that's really important because, I mean, you're gonna walk in on January 20th, you need to have the lay of the land to some extent. So I would say that, you know, after the Presidential Transition Act was passed, really those amendments after 9/11 were kind of the most substantial. Other sort of improvements that have been made are, there's a requirement that departments and agencies in January and February prepare briefing books for the incoming administrations. And there's all kinds of other sort of, the White House has to assign somebody to the transition to formalize it. And they've created positions so that really people have a realm of responsibility to make sure that these meetings happen and this preparation occurs. So I would say, you know, since 1963, we've done a pretty good job at formalizing this. But it's kind of interesting to me that before 1963, nothing formal. So since then, and I would say jumping from JFK in 1960 to 61 with his transition, the most notable transition after that was 2008. And that's considered to be the gold standard of presidential transitions. And I think it's largely fueled by the fact that the year 2000 had the contested election in Florida, and it meant that the transition for Bush-Cheney was much shorter than his predecessors. I think it was early December that the court made their decision. And because of the 9/11 reports and suggestions, recommendations, it was really important to George W. Bush to do the right thing and to make sure that his successor was as prepared as possible. So you can interview people in the Bush administration, you can interview people in the Obama administration, and they will all tell you, those people who worked on it, that the degree of professionalism was fantastic, that it was just tremendously helpful. So going forward, Obama, of course, likewise did the same thing, told his administration, this is something we really need to take seriously. And they did. The problem was the Trump people, the Trump transition team, had sort of a travesty occur. Right after the election, President Trump decided to fire Chris Christie. And in addition to doing that, they also apparently, according to Michael Lewis's book, The Fifth Risk, they threw out all of the materials that Christie had been working on the previous 6 months. And because of the Presidential Transitions Act, they were able to hire people for the transition. They had office space. I mean, it was a professional organization. And they just threw it out. I don't know who's that. That's maybe, that probably helps explain why there were so many vacancies, why they had such difficulty getting people nominated, why they had so many nomination withdrawals. I'm not sure. But the Obama administration held tabletop exercises, you know, meetings across the government. And if all you have to do is read Michael Lewis to get a sense that it really wasn't reciprocated. There wasn't really this thirst for knowledge to kind of try to figure out what the lay of the land was. So now we're at 2020, 2021. And as I mentioned, we had the delay from the GSA administrator. But what's interesting, and I would say sort of most fortunate at this moment, is we have an incoming administration that has the most experience of any of his predecessors. Not just his Biden's experience in the Senate, but his experience as a vice president for 8 years. And then he surrounded himself with people that he either knew when he was in the Senate or he knew when he was in the Obama administration. The degree of experience is so helpful at this moment because they know exactly what they need to do. In addition to that, it was very helpful that Biden was the presumptive nominee as of about April of 2020, because that enabled the campaign. At that point, it's probably a very small people dedicated to the transition. But over time, you know, they were already kind of vetting candidates, I'm pretty sure, as informally as they could, and preparing. There's a really interesting article that just came out the last couple of days by NBC News saying that his, I'm blanking on the name, but that they were prepared. They had a sense that there could be a problem with ascertainment. They knew the election would be close. They were getting briefings on ascertainment in June. These people knew, I mean, Trump was telegraphing that he was going to challenge the election results. These people knew that something was going to happen. So they prepared for it. And I think at this moment in history, we couldn't be more fortunate than to have people with experience that could have foreseen and took it very seriously, took the transition very seriously. So now we're, you know, 2020, finally ascertainment occurs, and then you just see a very disciplined incoming administration. There wasn't a lot of huffing and puffing about the lack of ascertainment. There were no threats to sue, you know, nothing like that. They just sort of kept their nose to the grindstone and churned out appointments and announcements and did so, I thought, in a very disciplined manner. The president-elect spoke when he needed to speak, like in the aftermath of January 6th. And things of that nature. And if you look at the pace of his appointments to the cabinet and to White House staff, interestingly, the White House Transition Project has monitored the pace of appointments. And going all the way back to Jimmy Carter, President-elect Biden was ahead of seven predecessors, despite the fact that he lost about 25% of the time because of the delay in ascertainment. It's also worth noting that of the appointments he's made, he's appointed more. If you just look at the 15 cabinet departments that are in the line of presidential succession, he's appointed more women than any of his predecessors going back to Reagan. He's appointed about the same number of non-whites to the cabinet. But I would say that the data on its face undersell the fact that there are some important historical firsts. He appointed the first immigrant and the first Latino to run the Department of Homeland Security. He appointed the first Black to run the Defense Department. He appointed the first woman to run the Department of the Treasury, and he appointed the first Native American ever to the cabinet. And not only that, he selected her to be in the interior, to run the Interior Department. So the numbers alone, to me, don't really convey the historic nature and the intense commitment to diversity. And I'm still collecting the data on the White House staff, but I can just tell you on its face, there are far more women in senior positions than there have ever been in any other administration. So he's holding true to his word. I mean, he needs to do this in a way. If you look at the election results, Black women were critical to his re-election or his election, and women in the suburbs. And just generally speaking, I think he is committed to the idea that, you know, women deserve, you know, equal opportunity, equal pay, all of those things. And it probably doesn't help. I mean, it does help probably to have a wife like Jill Biden, who's, you know, always been in the workforce and clearly cares a lot about women's issues. So, you know, not only the number, sheer number of his appointments, but the types of individuals he is hiring signal fulfillment of his campaign promises and a commitment to diversity. In terms of what will happen in the next week and whether he will get key members of his cabinet confirmed, just this morning, I went back to look at the data from President George W. Bush, President Obama, and then including President Trump. And President Trump only had two individuals confirmed on Inauguration Day. President Obama had six. And I need to check my data, but I think that President Bush had a lot. I think he had 10 or 12.
And my next question for you as you're looking that up is about some of this, what we would call timeliness. And having people kind of, you know, in the starting blocks, ready to go.
Oh, okay. Yeah, and why that matters. The number of secretaries confirmed on Inauguration Day were two for President Trump, six for President Obama, and 10 for George W. Bush, which is interesting because of those three, he had the shortest transition because of the Florida recount. And then President Bush had all 14 confirmed by 30 days.
It's almost as if like George W. Bush and Biden, because of what happened to them, have this sort of critical, okay, we have to be focused on this. Again, it's so small n, but it seems like as if their teams did something very particular to make this happen.
Right. And if you think about also the common denominator, they both had incredible experience in the executive branch. I mean, well, I know that George Bush was a governor, but his family, his father being president, and he called on Dick Cheney, who had a fair amount of experience in the executive branch. So,
I mean, you know this better than I do, Katie, but I would assume, and I think I recall this at the time, that Cheney was kind of somewhat in charge of the transition in a lot of ways, maybe not officially, but that, you know, because he had so much experience in as Secretary of Defense and on Capitol Hill and so forth, that he had a strong hand in a lot of that.
That's exactly right. Dick Cheney was deeply involved in the transition. And apparently during that period, during the recount, he was running the transition out of his living room for a while. And then once the ascertainment occurred, they got more access to more and more buildings. Interestingly, this year, you know, Emily Murphy was late in granting the ascertainment. And so it added an additional building where the transition staff would go. And I read that both of the buildings were almost empty because of COVID. So that really wasn't much of a help. The office space part this year wasn't much of a help. But yeah, you're exactly right. Dick Cheney did a lot with the transition in the 2000-2001 period. But yeah, I suspect that what's interesting about these, comparing these four presidents too, in terms of how many did they get inaugurated, did they get confirmed on inauguration and in within the first 100 days, all of them, interestingly, had their party as the majority party in the Senate. But yet Bush was far more effective. I mean, getting 10 through on that first day, and Trump only getting two. And both Trump and Obama took the full 100 days to have their whole, either 14 or 15, The reason that Obama had 14, not 15, is because I didn't remember this until thinking about it today, was that, remember, he kept on Robert Gates as the defense secretary.
Oh, that's right.
Holdover. Yeah.
So he didn't have to have him reconfirmed.
He didn't have to do that one. Yeah. But it's really important that presidents get their team in place. Leadership matters a great deal. And delaying these appointments just sort of stifles the efforts and the agenda setting. And pretty soon, or actually, I think on day one, President Biden will be issuing a large number of executive orders. And so he needs the executive branch to implement those executive orders. So I assume he has a fair number of political people that did not need Senate confirmation will be in those jobs starting Wednesday. And that will be helpful because I'm sure they can do some things. They can't do everything, but I'm sure they can at least help get things going. It's not the end of the world, but I would argue that in the midst of a pandemic, in the midst of economic volatility, in the midst of historically high racial tension, we really need to be focused on getting leaders in place.
Yeah. So
I would think that the Senate really, I know they have an impeachment trial, but they'd really need to get going on these things. And hopefully the Biden team's experience has informed all of these nominees. Listen, you have to have all the financial records in place. Like, here's what you need to do to get ready. I know the Partnership for Public Service has done a great deal of work to try to help nominees get ready for the hearings and everything. So I'm hoping that they have all of their ducks in a row, because sometimes that can slip you up. I know part of the delay for a lot of the Trump people was, you know, like an unwillingness to turn over financial records or not taking the questionnaire as seriously as they should have and things like that. So hopefully that will be different this time.
And I also remember right at the beginning of the Trump administration, as he was, about to take the oath of office, he also said that all of the ambassadors, American ambassadors, were officially relieved of their posts on January 20th at noon, which then adds another 150 or something people who the Senate has to confirm in the process of also confirming the top level cabinet appointees and all of the sub-level cabinet appointees. And I remember consulting with you at a couple points about like how many slots at the State Department were still open well into the Trump administration, which is, again, separate to some degree from a lot of these other political appointments.
Yeah. And it's their prerogative as a president. They can ask all of the U.S. attorneys and have them be fired, ask them to resign as well. But again, you have to think of the context in which you're governing. I mean, does this really serve your interest going forward? Did it really serve the Trump administration's interest to get rid of the ambassador in Chad or in Germany? Or I probably not think so. You know, I just it doesn't strike me. If there was a country that was of utmost importance at that point, well, then get a nominee through quick, you know, and just appoint that individual. These blanket resignations, sometimes to me, they signal kind of like an anger. And I suspect that Biden, given his whole ethos of uniting the country and bringing people together, I don't think that that's, if you've noticed, his language has been very measured, very moderated. I would be shocked if he did something like that. And again, as you say, it just adds to the kind of the waiting line that you've already got going for these confirmation positions. And that's just not helpful at this point.
What it did for Trump, though, was to establish his credentials as an anti-establishment candidate. So in a way, for all of the reasons that you don't want to see him do it or Biden wouldn't do it, in fact, Trump needed to do it in order to show that he was anti-Washington, he was anti-government, he was quote unquote, going to clear the swamp. So I think that's part of it. And anti-establishment politics have high costs, and that then you need people to train people to do jobs that other people have spent their entire lives learning to do. So, yeah. And I think some of that actually came out during the impeachment hearings, as they're describing people who know Ukrainian politics because they've been studying it for decades, as opposed to somebody who's new to the game, who's looking at a one-page briefing and doesn't understand the context of which a particular gesture, they miss the nuances, et cetera. So it's a real contrast, obviously, between Trump's anti-establishment entry into the government and for whatever sharing of party that Bush has with Trump. Bush was still an establishment Republican in many ways.
Right. And I think that the Trump Trump himself and the people surrounding him had no interest in investing in the institutions and learning what the consequences of these anti-establishmentarian acts would be. It was of no concern. In a way, what they did is they undermined their best efforts. And while I was tracking the turnover in the White House, and of course the numbers were off the charts, you know, he was all about like, oh, I like being flexible and picking the people I want to pick. But he didn't realize he was undermining his effort at the same time. I mean, I've done a lot of oral histories where people who have worked in the White House say it takes them roughly 6 months to get themselves up to speed, to figure out what they're doing. And then about 9 months later, there's often sort of burnout. There's too much pressure. The hours are too long. It's completely understandable. A lot of people stay like 15, 18 months or so. But if you keep firing people such that you have four national security advisors and, you know, multiple chiefs of staff, you never get any sort of pattern. And I think one analogy that works well with a lot of people is to think about a team, like a basketball team or any sort of team. Like if you keep pulling out players and inserting new ones, they never really learn how to work together. And I think all of that undermined, you know, Trump's ability to implement some of his ideas and some of his programs. We never did have Infrastructure Week, did we? I mean, maybe we could have done better those kinds of things if there had been less turnover. And I understand he has the right to fire people, but, you know, at that level, you're just dealing with chaos at that point, because it's just the turnover is just too high.
I wanted to ask you a little bit, Katie, about some of the comments that you made in your first discussion about how diverse the new group of appointees are, not only in terms of like the number of women on the White House staff and the fact that the entire communications staff is all female, but also, as you note, that the people who are filling some of these roles are particularly unique in the diversity that they are bringing. Can you talk to us a little bit more about the comparison across recent administrations, or even, you know, the first woman to serve during the Roosevelt administration and so forth?
Yeah. So in the case of the Biden team in the White House so far, you just see a mix of, you know, Latinos, mixed race, Black, and you just, at least in the Trump White House, and to some extent you did in the Obama administration, but the Trump White House was predominantly white. And not only that, the woman that President Biden has appointed to be the UN representative is just steeped in knowledge. She's worked at the State Department for decades. And she is Black, but she's extraordinarily experienced in sort of to bring together the richness of this diversity and the richness of these different perspectives. It shows that Biden wants a variety of opinions and perspectives. And as people have been saying for years, bringing lots of different people to the table results in the best types of decision-making. You're not just getting sort of one type of answer or one type of perspective on things. And so I think it will behoove the administration. It's not just a campaign promise. It will make governing better.
You have fabulous charts, and we will link your most recent Brookings piece, which maybe won't be the most recent when we actually drop this podcast tomorrow, on just how diverse is Biden's prospective cabinet. And you have these great charts. And if you just look at the charts, it doesn't look as spectacular somehow. But as you've said, it's really about which appointments and the fact that, for example, something like Treasury has never been held by a woman. But one shift that I took away from your charts was that there are very few people of Asian heritage in Biden's cabinet. Lots of Latinos, a very, very serious increase. And I'm wondering what you make of that shift and what would explain it.
Well, one of the things that's really important to point out is it's just an N of 15. And 15 is a very small number. So I don't think you can draw, you know, any kind of conclusions about his attitude towards hiring Asians or anything of that nature. It is just a small sample, but the reason it's useful is that cabinets can be whatever a president wants to be. They can elevate positions to be what's called cabinet level. And so if you go back to just to Reagan and you go forward, the end changes all the time. And I learned from my colleague, Steve Hess at Brookings, that one of the Eisenhower cabinet level individuals was basically given the position because it was a favor. He was really helpful in the campaign. So it's not always for substantive reasons that these people get cabinet rank. So I decided just methodologically, it's better apples to apples to compare only the top 15 in the line of presidential succession. So it's a small N, so I really wouldn't draw too many conclusions. And I would point out that the Biden's nominee to be the United States trade representative is Asian. And I'm sure there'll be many more. But yeah, there's probably some criticism that he's getting on that end from those groups, for sure. But again, it's a small subset. And I point out in the article that, you know, this is probably the most visible subset of presidential appointments, but it's 15 Senate confirmed positions out of roughly 12 to 1300. So I am sure that one of the projects I have that's forthcoming is at the 100-day mark, the 200-day mark, and the 300-day mark, I'm comparing confirmed nominees going back to President George W. Bush so that you can see how Biden compares, not just in pace, but in gender and diversity, racial and ethnic diversity. So that'll be kind of a better report card, so to speak, because the N will be bigger. And, you know, of course, you can compare to most recent, the three most recent presidents, which I think will be more insightful and probably more reflective. The White House listing is a little bit more complicated to compare because presidents oftentimes create new positions. It's hard to get sort of a universal list. There is no comprehensive list that's publicly available. So I'll have to kind of probably break it down according to rank, like all of the appointees that are assistants to the presidents, deputy assistants, and special assistants, and kind of compare it that way. But that's a tougher comparison to make just because of the, just, you know, presidents sort of have different ideas about how to staff the White House. A lot of the positions are there from administration to administration, but nevertheless, they kind of change things so that it's hard to do apples to apples.
One of the standard lines that I've been hearing is how old Biden's cabinet is, but when I looked at your numbers, it really showed that the median age for the cabinet was lower than Trump's and on par with many previous presidents, except Bill Clinton's, which was interesting that he had a much younger cabinet. You've talked a lot about experience. Is there for you any risk that people are too confident or invested in older ways that maybe we will need flexibility? What do you think about the age of the cabinet? Did your numbers surprise you as well?
A little bit, but not really. He's right in there with the average. I do think that experience matters, especially, again, this is the subset of the 15 cabinet secretaries. Usually you get to be cabinet secretary because you had a highly esteemed career. You've been very active in party politics. You may have even served in public office. And that kind of brings you to the forefront so that you get selected. So the age part doesn't surprise me. Maybe in a subsequent study, if I look at the age of White House staffers, if that's a lot older, then that may raise some red flags, but I actually don't think so. White House staffers tend to be younger. Again, the hours are ridiculous, the demands. There are still some highly experienced. I mean, Ron Klain has a great deal of prior experience. I actually have data that I'll show you in a future. We'll have a future podcast, but I have data going back to Reagan that compares, of the various A teams, who had the most experience with their White Houses, like how many had worked in prior White Houses. And you won't be surprised to know that most of Trump's people came from the private sector and they had far less experience, which again, I think hindered their capacity to really perform well. So experience matters in these jobs for sure. And one other point I'd like to make, especially when I'm talking to sort of foreign journalists and the like, is that this is unlike any other job. You could be the CEO of ExxonMobil or you could be the CEO of Whole Foods, some major company. But in this particular job, you get in and the clock is ticking. It is January 20th and you are going to be out in 4 years. So it really puts a premium on kind of putting your best foot forward, having the most energy, having people in place. And that's why you do see some turnover. It's just hard to sustain that level. It's basically you're running at 95 to 100% all of the time because you know that you have to. Especially this first 6 months, they feel like they have somewhat of a honeymoon, even though political scientists think otherwise of honeymoons. The perception is that that's when they have the most political capital and can get the most done. So there's a lot of pressure on them, and they'll do the best they can in the coming days, but it's not easy.
And I just wanted to ask a question a little bit about not only the experience of the people coming into the cabinet, but also the fact that Biden has pulled a couple people out of the House, but then they said, you know, no more because we have a very narrow majority here. And he didn't pull anyone out of the Senate for obvious reasons. So compared to previous administrations, perhaps the Trump administration aside, how many or how few legislators or former legislators do we have comparatively?
Oh, that's a good question. You know, I have all the data. I just have to glance at it to figure it out. But you're right, like President Clinton had Henry Cisneros, who had been the mayor of San Antonio. This time we have Jennifer Granholm, the former Michigan governor. I actually need to do that in a subsequent analysis, but that's an interesting question. So are you more concerned with drawing them out of Congress or any prior elected office?
No, I was interested about drawing them out of Congress in part because not only of the narrow majorities that Democrats are holding in both houses, but also about the capacity to negotiate with former colleagues. And obviously, Biden has a lot of this experience on his own because he was in the Senate for so long and knows quite a few of those people. And he was also Obama's negotiator a lot of the time with folks on Capitol Hill because of his long history there. But I'm wondering about, you know, some of the folks who are coming out of the House, are they going to be able to help with some of the negotiation, potentially bipartisan negotiation on some of these big packages like the COVID relief plan and so forth?
You're thinking of like Marsha Fudge, for instance? Well, two things I'd say on that. One is it depends if it's kind of in her milieu of the cabinet that she's, I mean, she can help advance the legislation that's emanating from her department or that will be implemented from her department, I would imagine. But as political scientists, we know a lot about how cabinet secretaries are really far flung and that the White House is really pulling the strings here. They're basically the puppeteers and they instruct the cabinet secretary in the White House is gonna instruct the various secretaries across the government about what they need to prioritize, where they need to go give speeches. So because the power has become so focused within the White House, the locus of power, I'm sure they can benefit from prior congressional experience, but I think that's probably less important with this president given his extensive career in the Senate and his knowledge of those individuals. But it's an important point going forward. Like how many are you willing to take out of Congress? You know, kind of it's at your own peril to some extent. Even if you have a healthy majority, you don't want to lose your supporters in the House or in the Senate, definitely in the Senate. I imagine that there were some people that the Biden people, candidates that the Biden people had queued up. And then once they realized how tight things were, those people got nixed.
Speaking of Congress, right now, five people are going to be before the Senate or already have. Some of them have been through this morning. Any surprises for you in them looking at Yellen for Treasury Secretary, Haynes for the Director of National Security, Mayorkas? Is that how you say his name?
Mayorkas? Yeah.
For Secretary of Homeland Security, Blinken for Secretary of State, and Austin for Secretary of Defense. Are you expecting any big news today?
Yeah, I'm not. You mean in terms of like dissent from the minorities?
I mean, it's odd that the Republicans are running the committees, right? Because they have this temporary majority because both of the senators from Georgia haven't yet been sworn in. So I don't know if you expect anything. I mean,
it struck me even when he appointed them, 6 weeks ago, 8 weeks ago, none of them were really controversial figures to me. Again, in his whole kind of spirit of moderation and unification, he hasn't really picked anybody that's a barn burner. Like I know that Sally Yates was apparently on the list for Attorney General, but that would have sparked a fair amount of opposition from Republicans. And it seems as though he's steered clear. In some cases, these people have already prepared for hearings in the past, like Mayorkas was, I think he was the deputy Homeland Security director deputy secretary of the Department of Homeland Security. So some of them have already been through this process before and kind of know the ropes. I know that Austin was somewhat problematic because they need to get that waiver. I understand it has to be voted by both houses. I thought it was just the Senate, but somebody told me it was both houses. And I also think that the Biden administration is playing things as safe as possible. So I suspect they've been vetted. They've had mock hearings. They've gone through everything from A to Z because they don't want to slip up. They don't want to expend any political capital on these people. And so they went with safe choices, and they're hoping to minimize any opposition. That just seems to kind of be their modus operandi to date. You know, just ever since the election was declared to be the one that they won, they seem to be kind of just really playing things cool and safe.
And thanks so much for joining us today, Katie. It's been really useful and interesting to talk to you about presidential transitions, cabinet appointments, the history of the transition process. Again, I mean, I remember 2008, but I didn't know that there was no formalization until, you know, sort of in the 60s and later. So I really appreciate that. And I look forward to talking to you more about your data sets as they evolve.
Great. I look forward to it. I'd love to come back. So please invite me. And thank you so much.
Oh, we will. Thanks so much, Katie.
Sure.